And welcome back to another special segment of Coast to Coast AM with Jonathan Downs. Up next, the Loch Ness Monster. Jonathan Downs is with us. Jonathan, what is the Center for Fortean Zoology?
Well, we're the only organization in the world that works full-time at hunting for unknown animal species. We've got 450 members over the world. And anybody who's listening tonight, welcome to join. You just go to our website and you can join up. There's some information on how to join on the front page of the website. But we've got 450-odd members around the world, and we've got 8 people now working full-time at this. Oh, sorry.
Good for you. And what website do you prefer they go to when it comes to this? Uh-oh.
That was my fault, George.
That's okay.
Break. I was having my breakfast during the break.
And you're choking.
So remember, it's only just past 8 o'clock here. I'm sitting up in bed with my cat and my darling girlfriend just brought me breakfast.
And you're choking to death live on the
radio. I was swallowing my toast, and I heard the advert finish. I'm so very sorry. Now I'm talking to millions of you across America.
Yes, you
are.
Get a little swig of water there.
Hold up. Be back in a second.
Okay, Jonathan. Look, I got to tell you, this is one of the reasons why I have never eaten when I'm ready to do a show. I mean, I have like a 3-hour before
I've
a program.
Never choked, I've never choked in front of millions of people.
Jonathan, let me tell you something. Years ago when I was doing my local show in St. Louis, Missouri, somebody brought us, and I love cashews. I love them. And somebody brought us some cashews. They happen to have been salted, which isn't the greatest thing for you, and brought them into the studio. Now, you know, this is almost 10 years ago. So I'm in there doing this talk show, relatively new, and I start popping these cashews during commercial breaks. And the salt hit me all of a sudden. And it was, for a talk show host, one of the most frightening experiences because, you know, you're gagging and you're coughing, and we've got these special cough buttons. You don't have them, obviously, where we push a button and nobody could hear us gagging and coughing. But I made it a rule for myself that the only thing I bring into a studio is a glass of water or tea. And that's it for me. I will not eat anything hours before air because it'll shut your throat down.
Yes. And I was just being greedy. I was just having my breakfast while I was talking to you guys.
Well, yeah, you were comfortable. You're doing an international show. You're lying in bed. You've got your breakfast served to you. I can understand that.
So I apologize to all you listeners out there. You had to hear me spluttering on my toast and marmalade. But anyway, I can't remember where we were. What was the question?
Well, at least we know it's live radio, don't we?
Well, you very nearly, earlier in the show, if you heard a funny clunking noise, it was my cat. Because I was sitting up in bed, it was my cat trying to sit on my shoulder while I was talking to you all. So.
All right, well, we were talking about your Center for Fortean Zoology and what it was exactly.
Well, it's two things. It is it's an organization. It's a society for studying mystery animals, which anybody can join, and which you can join through the website, which is www.cfz.org.uk. But now we're in the process of actually building a permanent center. Now, for years, as I think I was saying earlier, we were based in a little house in the middle of a suburban housing estate in the city of Exeter. But last year, sadly, at the age of 81, my father died, and I inherited my old family home. And most of the house was built in about 1800. And it's got big stone floors and oak beams and 3 or 4 resident ghosts. But bits of it, even older than that, bits of it are about 1600.
Yeah.
Bits of it were added on more recently. It's a big rambling house without buildings and grounds. And up at the top of the grounds, we've got some outbuildings which we're converting now into a museum, laboratory, and library. So we've now got a proper physical centre as well as having an organisation, a section of websites. We've now got a physical centre that all members are welcome to come and visit all year round, which is where we keep a collection of exotic animals and our museum exhibits.
I've got, you know what, if I ever make it out that way, I've got to come by and see this. I mean, this
sounds fantastic.
Well,
you're welcome. Anytime you're in England, George, you're welcome to.
I will.
Because my house is, it's somewhere between an old English, an old Victorian English gentleman's naturalist's club, and on the other side, or a bit of a sort of 1960s hippie commune, because people, an Australian guy came to visit once for a weekend. He stayed 3 months. And this is just what happens, you know?
I love it. Hey, let me ask you before we get into Loch Ness. The mood of the country now that your soldiers, the sailors and Marines, have been released. Of course, they're at the airport. I'll check to see if they're up in the air yet. But that's got to be great news for you, Brits. How does that affect your feelings about Iran as a nation?
To be quite honest, I didn't know this morning. I didn't know that they've been released, have they?
Yeah, as a matter of fact,
Remember, it's 9 o'clock at night for you.
That's right.
First thing in the morning. What's happened?
Well, they are releasing them. They're at the airport in Tehran right now. They may already be up in the air, and they're coming back home. And Ahmadinejad, the Iranian president, the one who has said some very strange, whacked out things in his career, has basically said that this is a gift to the British people, and you've been good to us, and off they go. So that conflict will be resolved. I'm just wondering what it means for the future, the standoff with the Iranians over their nuclear capabilities. I wonder if this gesture will keep Britain from getting involved in that.
Well, to be quite honest, I hope and pray that nothing bad's going to happen. I hope that there isn't going to be another war. Iran is a very beautiful place. I went there years and years and years ago, back in the 1960s when it was still ruled by the Shah.
Yes.
I went to Tehran, and it's one of the most beautiful, back in 1968 anyway, it was one of the most beautiful cities I've ever been to. It was like something out of one of the old Sinbad films from the 1950s. Absolutely beautiful place. And I was at school with some Iranian children, and the people are lovely. It's the politicians that mess everything up.
Yes, they are. I would concur. The Iranian people that I know, specifically in Los Angeles, are heartwarming, lovely, caring people, and I've got to believe most of them in Iran are that way.
I think people are basically good. It's politics that gets in the way.
I think, and greed, Jonathan.
Yes.
And greed. The politics and the greed, and they begin to manipulate people, and man, the worst. Anyway, let's talk about some fun things. When I was a boy, there were two creatures that captured my imagination. One was what we've talked about, the abominable snowman. I couldn't get enough material on reading about Yeti and those stories. And then the other, of course, was the Loch Ness Monster in Scotland. Tell me about the loch itself. What does it look like? And the stories have been around for years.
Oh, there's been stories of strange creatures in the loch for hundreds and hundreds of years. It's a very strange place. It's the biggest area of water in the United Kingdom, biggest area of fresh water in the United Kingdom. It's the deepest lake in the United Kingdom, and it's very long and thin, surrounded by mountains. It's very, very spooky, but there's one thing from a zoological point of view which has to be remembered. It's a deep glacial lake. And there's very little in there. There's very little fish in there. It's got a very poor population of fish because it's so cold, and there's very few nutrients, which is one of the big things that you have to take into consideration when you're talking about the Loch Ness Monster.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is where I think some of your listeners might be able to help me. Because you can't see the Loch Ness Monster in isolation. It's only one of dozens of lakes all across the Northern Hemisphere where the same sort of things are reported. There's at least three in Scotland. There's three or four in Ireland, a couple in Wales. There are lakes all across North America.
We've got one in Lake Champlain.
Lake Champlain. Champlain, Lake Okanagan, Lake Winnipeg, Osis. There's lakes all across the Northern Hemisphere, all across Northern Russia, Northern China, Japan, Korea, all across the Northern Hemisphere, there are lakes where there are monsters reported.
And same creature, unlike the chupacabra and the possibility of Bigfoot being one of several. Same creature for this?
Yes, you've not you put the nail on the head. The same phenomenon. It's exactly the opposite. All these lakes, I think in the vast majority of them, there are a couple where I think there might be a something different there. We'll come back to that later. Lake Okanagan in Canada, for example, I think there's something different in. And also a lake called Lake Tianchi, which is on the borders of North Korea and China. I think there is a totally unique creature there as well. But most of the lakes on the Northern Hemisphere where there are lake monsters reported, I think the explanation's the same. Now, for years, people have been reporting something in Loch Ness. And the popular explanation is that it is something from the age of the dinosaurs. But that doesn't hold water. For one thing, it was frozen solid in the last ice age. For another thing, that all the prehistoric reptiles that lived in the water, the prehistoric marine and freshwater reptiles, they were air breathers. They would have come up to the surface to breathe air. And although there are two or three reports a year of something enormous in Loch Ness, there are just not enough sightings that there would be if something was coming up to the air to the surface to breed. Also, they would have come onto land to have their babies. And although there have been a handful of land sightings, there's very, very few and far between. Another problem is that in order to keep a viable population, you need at least 14 individual animals. And there just isn't enough biomass in the lake. There just isn't enough, aren't enough fish in there to support a viable population of huge predators. So what on earth can it be? What we believe is that we're talking about a giant eel.
A giant eel. Okay, there's a fellow by the name of Steve Alton believes the same thing.
Yes. Very much so. And this is where it gets exciting. Because what I love about the natural sciences is that despite the popular belief that we know everything about the world, we don't. Now, it's only been in the 1940s, it was only been since the 1940s that we knew how the European eel breeds, how the European eel's biology works. But it was only since last September, October 2006, that we knew how the Pacific eels live. Now, there are three main species of eel in the Northern Hemisphere. You've got the North American eel, you've got the European eel, and you've got something called the Japanese eel, which is all across Asia. But they're all very, very, very closely related. Now, all the eels on the Atlantic coast of Europe and the Atlantic coast of North America, we've known since the 1940s that when they reach sexual maturity, the adults swim down to the sea. As soon as they get in the salt water, they can't feed. I don't know why they can't feed. No one knows why they can't feed. But they get in the salt water, and they swim down to a place called the Sargasso Sea off the coast of Florida,
right.
which has always amused me. It's actually in the middle of the Bermuda Triangle, which I've always found quite funny, where they mate, they spawn, they die, and the eggs hatch into funny little things called leptocephali, which are about the size of your little fingernail, which are the shape of leaves. And up until the 1940s, these were thought to be totally different, a totally different species of fish. But they swim back up the Atlantic, and as soon as they get in the coastal waters, they turn into little baby eels called elvers, and they swim up the rivers again, up to the lakes and rivers where they live until they're sexually mature, and the whole thing starts all over again. Now, it was only found out in the fall of last year that the ones on the Pacific coast, especially the Asian ones, but also the Pacific coast of North America, they do exactly the same thing, except these ones swim down to a place called the Mindanao Trench off the coast of the Philippines. And that was only discovered last year, which I think is exciting, you know, that a fish as well known as the North American eel, they didn't know how it bred until very, very recently.
I always hoped that it was a plesiosaur, Jonathan.
I'm afraid not. But I tell you what, this is quite exciting. Something, but if you can imagine that something causes one very occasionally an eel in a big population to become sterile, so it doesn't have the sexual imperative to swim into salt water.
Right.
It stays in fresh water and just gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Did you ever hear the theory back in the 30s that...
I'm not that old.
No, you're not that old, but what they saw, you know, when there's that incredible photo of Nessie from 1934 that has this huge neck-shaped thing sticking out of the water, some people theorize that there was an elephant swimming in the loch from one of the nearby circuses because they would go that way all the time. And if you look at the picture, then compare it to an elephant underwater where just his trunk is sticking out and part of his head, it looks almost the same. Is that possible?
I think it's very, very unlikely. It's a lovely story, but I don't think it's true. I think the vast majority of the sightings are giant eels. But if you can imagine, when I was fishing when I was a little boy, I was about 11 or 12, I caught an eel that was about 8 or 10 inches long, and it bit me on the finger. It hurt like nobody's business, and I've still got the scar now, 30 years later, I've still got the scar on my little finger. What I'm wondering, if we're right and there are eels of 15 or 20 foot long, and at any one time there's one or two of them in Loch Ness or Loch Morar or Lake Okanagan or Lake Champlain or these things, that's one hell of a monster.
Oh, it is. An eel is
20 foot long. You don't have to theorize Jurassic Park sort of scenario to have a monster. These are one hell of a monster. They'd be the big alpha predator. And wow, I would love to meet one.
Well, not too close, though.
Well, there's actually been reports of these in some lakes in the north of England, in a place called Lake Windermere. And we're up there next month trying to catch one.
I sure would make a lot of sushi if you're into sushi eel, John.
Oh, gosh, yes. I like sushi, and I'm a big man, so, you know, I can eat quite a lot, but even I'm not going to eat a 20-foot eel.
Well, I've got to tell you, it is a story that continues to perplex and fascinate. Are they still seeing something in the loch now?
Yes, they are. And if you go to our multimedia website, which is www.csvtv.org, if you look on the section which says what's on, there's a number of documentary films that we've made, including one which was made on Lake Windermere last year. And I've given it the dreadful title of Eel or No Eel, because I love bad puns. And that's got some eyewitness testimony of the eels in the English Lake District that only happened last year. We've got four or five different sets of witnesses up there, and you can see sort of live eyewitness testimony from them there.
By the way, your 15 British sailors and Marines are now in the air on their way back to England.
Thank goodness for that. That's one international crisis that looks like it's been averted for a while.
Absolutely. And it's about time, isn't it?
Oh, yes. I mean, it's been a very, very frightening situation. And I am sure these poor chaps have been in all our prayers, because not just for their own personal safety, but for what on earth was going to happen if they didn't get released.
Jonathan, when we come back, let's talk about Owlman, okay?
Yes, of course.
This is going to be one of those stories. I love these mysteries. I love these monsters. This is George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Yep, and Jonathan Downs is with us, and we're going to take phone calls next hour. But when we come back, it's Owlman time on Coast to Coast AM. Jonathan, Owlman, tell us about this.
Well, Owlman is sort of the English version of your Mothman, except it's been seen over a longer period of time. The first sightings took place... What day is it today in America? Are you still on Wednesday? I'm on Thursday.
We're in Thursday morning now.
Okay, we're Thursday morning, but about 9 hours ahead of you. But tomorrow's Good Friday. And on Good Friday 1976, so 31 years ago tomorrow, the first owl man sighting took place. There were two little girls who were on holiday with their family. And they were on holiday in a place in Cornwall, which is a very beautiful part of the United Kingdom, and a very wild country part of the United Kingdom. They were on holiday in Cornwall, a little village called Mornan Smith, 31 years ago tomorrow. And they were playing in the woods while their mum and dad were setting up a picnic lunch. And they came screaming, running out of the woods, saying they'd seen a nasty feathered bird man, a humanoid creature covered in feathers, flying in the air above a church tower. And they were so scared that their parents cut short their holiday and took them all the way back to the north of England again. And that was just the first of a whole string of sightings. There was another sighting a couple of months later in Cornwall, but in July 1976. And then through 77, 78, 80, 82, every year or so, there were another sightings. So to date, I think there's been over 40 different sightings by over 40 different witnesses in that area. And I collected these sightings together a few years ago, and I put them into a book called The Owl Man and Others, which is probably my most popular book. And last year, to mark the 30th anniversary of the sightings, we put out a special 30th anniversary edition, which has got all the original, as well as the story that was in the book. It's got updated, it's got interviews with witnesses, it's got photographs, it's got all the original press cuttings, a lot of stuff in it. But this has been something which has intrigued me over the years. It's a very, very grotesque, very weird story.
You know, as you say, it is similar to our own Mothman stories. In this country, Jonathan, Mothman seemed to appear during and right before severe moments of crises, a collapsed bridge where people died, wars, strange things. How about Owlman?
Now, it's strange. No, this is something where the parallel doesn't hold up. It seems I know one of the Owlman witnesses very well. He's a very good friend of mine. And it does seem to be, to me, that the people who witness Owlman, it screws up their minds. It screws up their minds forever. It seems, whereas the Mothman reports in the United States seem to sort of be precursors of tragedies, the most famous one being the collapse of the bridge at Point Pleasant in West Virginia in 1967, wasn't it?
Right, that's right.
Yes, again, 40 years ago this year. And there have been other reports that seem to presage big, either regional or national crises. It doesn't seem to be like that in the UK, but it does seem to, having an encounter with this creature, does seem to fry people's brains, and it has a definite effect on their mental health forever.
And how would you categorize this case, the Owl Man, compared to some of your other cryptozoology creatures?
Oh, yeah, the Owl Man is most definitely something paranormal. I don't like using the word paranormal, but because I think it's sort of lazy journalism to call it paranormal, because that just means it just doesn't fit into any recognized scientific terms of reference. It's not an animal. It's something very, very weird. I think if I had to categorize it, I'd say it's a sort of three-dimensional poltergeist. It's something that comes from within us rather than from outside.
That's fascinating. Now, you've investigated animal mutilations in Mexico. Have you also looked at the possible link between these mutilations and UFO cases?
Yes, on a number of occasions, both in Mexico and in the UK. And one of the most interesting cases that I've ever dealt with was in a little village in the Puebla Desert, which was just underneath Popocatépetl. Now, this was a incident that took place in July 1996, in which, in this little village, there'd been nine creatures in three different farms were attacked on the same night. And in this one farm that I visited, two sheep and a goat had been attacked. And the first person to be called to the scene was a Mexican vet. I mean, can you hear the can you hear this in Mexico? I mean, does your broadcast?
Oh yeah, we get sure, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, if there's anybody in the area of Puebla who knows a vet called Soledad de la Peña, and I'm sorry my pronunciation's dreadful, but Soledad de la Peña, if you're here listening to this, and I know that you were a fan of Art Bell 10 years ago, so if you are listening to this, can you try and contact me through the radio show, please? But she investigated this. She was called to the farmyard to look at this, and she found that these creatures had been completely drained of blood, but at least one of them was still alive. And there's a very famous piece of footage of her putting a white cotton glove on, making a hand into a fist, and putting it into the hole in the breastbone of one of these sheep, and pulling it out, there's no blood on her hands. It's incredibly, incredibly strange. Now, she showed me, and this is why I want to talk to her, she showed me some fascinating video footage that she'd taken of what appear to be glowing balls of light, which appear to be solid, some sort of a UFO phenomenon, coming out of the crater of Popocatépetl, you know, the active volcano. And that's a few miles up the road. And this is one incredibly fascinating, phenomenon. And she believes that there is a direct link between the UFOs and the animal mutilations, the exsanguination of these creatures. And what I remember talking to somebody at the time who had said that these glowing balls of light that were coming out of Popocatépetl's crater, that there had been sightings of these UFOs hovering over the village at the time of the attacks. Now, I need to confirm that, because this is just my Spanish is not very good, and this is something that one of the villagers told me, because I went into the shop in the village to buy a pack of cigarettes, and I was talking to them, but my Spanish is very bad, their English was not good, and so I would like to actually try and confirm this story, because something very, very strange going on.
Oh, no question about it. These, you know, in France, they are releasing its UFO cases now to the public, which I think is pretty pretty aggressive. What about Britain?
In Britain, we've only just got a Freedom of Information Act. So we've only had a Freedom of Information Act the last few years. You can get hold of this information, but it's still not taken very seriously by the mainstream. But I tell you what, each year in August, we have our annual convention that we call the Weird Weekend. And again, George, if you happen to be in England any August, you're welcome to come stay and come and join in.
Well, thank you.
Because we have the cream of the world's researchers coming into this little village in the Devon countryside talking about their particular subject. It's like a three-day version of your show, except with more beer. But we always, on the Thursday night before the weekend conference, we always have a cocktail party, and it started off with 8 or 9 people. The last year in my garden was 65 people, and they include some of the world's most famous ufologists, who I'm sure have been on your show. You've had Nick Redfern on your show, haven't you?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And you've had Larry Warren.
Yes, and we've had Nick Pope.
Well, me and Larry... My fiance, Larry, me and Nick, and a couple of other people were sitting around at a little table in my garden underneath the trees at about midnight, the night before the Weird Weekend. And particularly Larry and Nick had been drinking margaritas all evening, because we mix a very good margarita here. And they were a little bit worse for wear, and suddenly a flying triangle flew over my garden. Only about 100 feet above the garden.
Jonathan, after a few of the margaritas you probably made, it was probably somebody's boomerang.
Then again, no, because my girlfriend was there, and she was stone-cold sober, and she'll swear it, too.
Well, there's something going on up there. There's no doubt about that in my mind. You know, just recently, the former governor of Arizona, during that 1997 Phoenix Lights episodes, I don't know if you're familiar with that case.
Yes.
Thousands of people witnessed seeing this huge triangular-shaped object. Well, 10 years ago, when he was the governor, he held a news conference and brought out his chief of staff, but had him dressed up as an alien and kind of made fun of it, tongue in cheek, and felt so bad about it over the years. He came out publicly just a few months ago, last week on our show, and admitted that what he saw was indeed a UFO. And he believes it's extraterrestrial.
Good God.
Yeah, and that's pretty dramatic. When an elected official finally steps forward and says, you know what, I'm sorry, I made fun of this, there were reasons I had to do what I did, and he was going through some incredible things during his life 10 years ago. But to come forward now, I think, is pretty gutsy.
Yes, and I. That's very strange.
Do you investigate UFO cases specifically?
I have done. When I was younger, I did quite a lot. But I'm getting old now. Well, getting older than I was. And running the CSZ is now such a full-time occupation. These days, I concentrate purely on the animals because we're getting to be such a big organization now. And at any one time, we're doing research all over the world. And we're trying to publish 20 books a year at the moment as well. So we're running what's quite a large publishing outfit and coordinating research all over the world. Plus I've got a large collection of our own animals here. And I do a lot of work here in the UK as well. I do quite a lot of charity work as well, and I work for the local church as well. So basically I've got so much on my hat, so much on my plate, and the UFO research has gone by the wayside, I'm afraid, the last few years.
Remember a couple of weeks ago, scientists said that in Indonesia they discovered more species of animals, species that we'd never even known about before. Would you consider them or call them cryptozoologists as well?
I would, yes. I mean, some people wouldn't. Some people think that cryptozoology is purely about the big exciting things like lake monsters and man beasts. But to me, cryptozoology is about the study of unknown animals, whether it be unknown insects that are 2 inches long or an unknown whale that's 40 foot long. Because I think it's actually an ever more important thing in the world. And this is something which I think a lot of people miss. It's generally agreed these days that if the human race is to survive, we've got to keep the ecology of the planet as safe, as protected as possible. And so all the major countries in the world signed up to a big agreement on biodiversity about 15 years ago. And cryptozoology is the one branch of science which is looking at expanding our knowledge of the world's biodiversity. I think that the only way we are going to understand our environment anywhere in the world, and it's imperative we do understand our environment if we're going to survive as a species, is if we understand the complex relationship of all the different species that live there. And so I think that what we're doing isn't just pushing back the frontiers of human knowledge. I think in a very real way what we're doing is of paramount importance if the human race is going to survive.
What creature of all of them you've investigated would you like to find?
Oh.
Just one. You can only have one.
I can only have one, and you're probably going to laugh at this, because most of them, all the other stuff I've been talking about on the show so far today, they've been quite big, exciting things. But the one thing that fascinates me is a little island in the South Atlantic called St. Helena, which not more than 1 in 10 people's ever heard of. I mean, not more than 1 in 10 people in Britain's ever heard of, and it's been British for the last 200 years. It's a little island. You know where Ascension Island is?
Yeah.
It's about 800 miles south of Ascension Island. Back in 1815, when Britain finally defeated the Emperor Napoleon, we captured him for the second time and realized we had to put him somewhere so he wouldn't cause any more trouble. So we annexed this little island of St. Helena, up in the middle of nowhere in the South Atlantic. We also annexed Ascension Island to the north and a place called Tristan da Cunha to the south. And all three still belong to the British now, 200 years later. And St. Helena is the island where Napoleon died. But on this, something strange about island wildlife, island faunas. We talked earlier about Puerto Rico, and how on Puerto Rico there were strange the truth about the chupacabra. And on Madagascar, you've got 98% of the world's lemurs live there. And on Puerto Rico, the insects grew incredibly large. And on St. Helena, and until very recently, there was the world's largest earwig, which was 5 or 6 inches long. And I want to go back. That's the thing I want to do. I want to go back there. Most of all, I want to go back there and see if I can rediscover it. Because I want to discover the world's largest earwig. I think that's a cool. Really, really cool, groovy thing to do.
Do you believe in mermaids? What do you think they were?
Again, Mother Nature is very strange. If you look across the world, you've got the concept of parallel evolution. For example, in Australia, where the placental mammals never really took off. There were placental mammals, they died out. The marsupials adapted to fill every single ecological niche. And you had, until very recently, and it's probably still there, an animal called the marsupial wolf, the Tasmanian wolf, which looked exactly the same as a wolf or a large dog or coyote in the rest of the world. And evolution fills these gaps. And if you look at the North Atlantic and the South Pacific, if you look at the Antarctica and the Arctic Circle and the Antarctic Circle, you've got very, very close parallels between the animals that live there. And, for example, in the Antarctic, you have got elephant seals. In the Arctic, you've got walruses, both very, very large, slow-moving pinnipeds. Now, in the Antarctic, you've got an animal called the leopard seal, which is particularly large, particularly fast, and unlike most other seals. There isn't a known version of that living in the Arctic, but I think that the animals that have been reported by many people for hundreds of years in the Arctic Circle, at least the ones that the explorer George Steller saw and described as a sea monkey, I think that they are a rare and so far undiscovered species of seal that has flippers that look like arms and has a ape-like head that lives up in the Arctic Circle.
Well, I got to tell you, it's fascinating. I envy what you do. When you were a little boy, did you always have this interest in creatures?
Well, I was brought up in Hong Kong, which at that time was a British colony. And I know these days, you say Hong Kong to anyone, they think it's a big concrete jungle, the most urbanized place on earth. But even today, Hong Kong's got some amazing wild places. And so I was brought up amongst a dazzling array of weird creatures. There were killer sharks and giant lizards and monkeys and all sorts of things, you know, and porcupines and pangolins. And I saw these things as a kid. And I was fascinated by animals. But one day when I was 7 years old, my mother went and got me a library book. And it was called Myth or Monster. And it was one of the three great epiphanies of my life. I read this book and I realized that people were interested in things, that people believed the things like the Loch Ness Monster or sea serpents or the Yeti or Bigfoot. And it was one of the three great epiphanies of my life. I went to school the next day and I said, Miss, I'm going to become a monster hunter when I grow up. And she said, young man, if you don't know your 9x table, you will never become anything, let alone a monster hunter. Well, 40 years on, I'm a professional monster hunter. So that shows teachers don't always know what they're doing.
We're going to take calls next hour, Jonathan. People, you can relate your stories with us, your creature stories, and Jonathan wants information, which he'll tell you about next hour, because those of you in Mexico and other regions of this planet, Puerto Rico, you might be able to help him out. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment with your phone calls with our special guest cryptozoologist, Jonathan Downs, on Coast to Coast AM.